Today's program has been brought to you by Cain Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cain5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center, and today I'm actually out in California. We have an ICC here, but it's in South Bay, and I am lucky enough to be sitting in the private dining room at Quinn's with today's guest, none other, the two-star Michelin James Beard Award-winning chef Michael Tusk. Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Good. I mean, first of all, I have to say how beautiful this restaurant is. It is so elegant. It's so divine. It's so sophisticated, but not intimidating at all. It's so comfortable.
I appreciate
Congratulations.
I always want the diner to relax when they come here.
And your food is so delicious. If you've not been to Quinn's, it's on the bucket list of must-do in life. So we're going to find out about this in a minute. So, Michael, we're going to talk about you. I mean, here you were, 2011, Esquire Magazine, Best Restaurant, James Beard Award winner for the Pacific, and up for the Outstanding Chef for the whole United States last year. Zagat. You've won all of these awards. How did you do it? The thing I love is you're from New Jersey, right?
That is true.
Okay. So tell me about New Jersey. And is that where your Italian roots started?
No, I actually have, I'm sure some people are surprised now, no Italian really roots whatsoever. I basically was born in Paterson, New Jersey, and then my family moved further north, and there was like a pretty good amount of, you know, small farms in that area until they kind of disappeared due to like a big real estate kind of boom. But I did grow up with like, you pick strawberry fields, dairy farms and so forth. So I was always interested.
Jersey's name
is the Garden State.
The Garden State. So yeah. People don't realize that.
No. So, I was always, I always just loved to eat. And my extended family in New York were caterers. So, you know, from an early age, I just, whether it was carving the class turkey in home economics class or going on a field trip to like a...
You did home economics?
Oh, yeah.
What year?
I don't want to age myself by telling you.
I mean, how old were you when you did?
probably 15.
So a 15-year-old guy...
Yeah.
Did everybody have to do home economics or did you choose?
I think everybody had to do it, but, you know, we also had like the more, you know, masculine wood shop and so forth. But no, it was
Charlie Palmer, you know, was quarterback of his football team and he chose to do home economics.
Yeah, he's a great guy too. I like him.
And all the football players did it because they could eat in class.
Well, that was a, you know, primary objective also. So, no, I did that, and I was always, it was just love to eat and try different, foods as a kid. From, you know, my mom always told me that I was a bit different because my first trip to, just a family vacation where I discovered my love of snails and escargot, and then from that point on, it was frog's legs and just anything that was different than just, you know, what I was eating at home was always very stimulating to me.
All right, so then you went to Tulane to college, right?
I did.
How did you even know about New Orleans and what brought you down there?
I was actually going to the University of Arizona, and then I made the mistake of visiting my brother for, I think, Jazz Fest one year, and he was living in New Orleans, and the combination of food and music and just there was always an event going on, something to do. And, you know, especially the food, eating food in New Orleans at that time was, you know, that was probably at the heyday of, like, you know, Cape Paul's. And I had a girlfriend who, you know, was a server at, might have been Gautreaux's or another restaurant. You know, that was like, that restaurant was basically two blocks from where I lived. And you know, just started going to restaurants, and the older restaurants in New Orleans and the newer restaurants, and just started to love, you know, the cuisine of the South. And that just really, you know, got me to start working in some restaurants when I was in New Orleans and I was going to school. And because of the fact that I transferred colleges, I was behind, so I had to go to summer school, so that allowed me to start working in restaurants. And then I did some cooking for you know, just friends, and, you know, some fraternities where they asked me to cater some parties for them. And then there was a woman who was actually a great influence on me. A friend who's still in New Orleans took me to a small, it wasn't even a restaurant, it was like a shotgun house in New Orleans. He was from Chicago, and he somehow found this woman, and it was like everything was $3.50, and she just prepared you know, Creole cuisine. And we would sit down in her kitchen table. There was a jukebox, and her husband would be chopping up you know, all the peppers and peppers and onions at the table, and then everything was $3.50, and she would give us kind of seconds. So I'd have everything from, you know, classics like red beans and rice to, you know, we would actually ask her to make some things for us, and she would prepare them for us. And then that was, her name was Alberta Harris, and she was also a singer.
Yeah, she played in New York. She was a great blues singer, wasn't she? She was.
I don't know if it's
no,
the same one.
No, I'm thinking
one, but
Alberta Hunter.
Yeah, there you go.
Sorry.
This one, she was more, you know, she had her version of, like, Amazing Grace on the jukebox there, and I know she played it at Jazz Fest. And so I would ask her for some recipes, whether it was for, you know, here's like a kid from New Jersey asking this great woman from New Orleans, you know, how to make, you know, specialties like jambalaya and so forth. So she did give me her jambalaya recipe, which she opened up her Bible on the kitchen table when her husband John was chopping the peppers and gave me that. And then,
do you still use that recipe?
I still have it around, yeah. I don't make it as much as I did, but it definitely got me started with, like, how to prepare some of these dishes. And I think with cooking, it's always like seeing somebody, it's great to go to a school and learn from somebody who has a history in that type of, you know, how she cuisine, and she was able to show me.
She sat in her garden, an old pair of jeans, and she smiled at the sun and the pale olive trees. She wiped the dirt from.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
So then you went to CIA from New Orleans. When did the chef light bulb go off? During this time when you're cooking?
Well, I think I always kind of knew that I was going to go into a professional kitchen. In a project in, I think, sixth grade, you had to take a 8x10 you know, picture of yourself and then write a story. And my family always had that in our basement, and it said that I was either, you know, going to be a chef or you know, professional tennis player, and that didn't happen. It probably would have been more lucrative, but so I guess I predicted that was in, you know, when I was quite young, and I just always, you know, wanted to be in a kitchen, and I liked seeing the action and what was going on, and but I always was kind of guided by, you know, getting an education and not just going directly into a school and learning more about just kind of life in general. And so I was happy that I was able to study art history since, you know, I like having references to history and food and studying just how things kind of change mm-hmm. in general. And I think that was very helpful for me to you know, study art. I think I can talk to, you know, my cooks in the kitchen a little bit differently. And you know, I loved culinary school. I loved getting an art degree. I just try to combine the two of them, and it makes it more exciting to prepare.
So what did you... You know, you were already cooking professionally before you went to culinary school. So what did you learn at culinary school? And what was that phase of your life like?
I think I always wanted to get out as fast as possible just because I felt like, you know, it was just a time where I was just itching to be in a kitchen and working. And I would have probably, you know, done something in a faster, you know, I'm always doing something and I don't like to take a long period of time. And after going to get an art degree, I felt like I wanted to just get into a kitchen and either go to Europe or do something in a just, you know, soon thereafter. But it taught me how to work with, you know, you've got a diverse diversity of like who's actually going to, with so many schools around these days, there's so many different people with, you know, they may go straight from high school into, you know, culinary school. They may be a career change. They may, you know, just be going to not be in a kitchen, but to learn something else about, you know, food stylist. So the industry is so diverse that you have, you know, just a very diverse classrooms.
What I'm trying to get at is, where, you know, you have young cooks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe they learned on the job in a restaurant. Maybe they went to school. Doesn't matter. What should the head of a young cook be, either when they're first on the line, you know, first in a restaurant or just coming out of school? Where was your head in those days? What, you're a 2-star Michelin chef now, and we're going to go through the layers of what it took to get there. So where do you, what kind of headset do you need when you're at that entry level?
I think even now you just have to get out of like a mindset that you know, that this is a glamorous kind of business. And I think at the base level, it's a lot of work every day. There's like so many components into what the guest is, what you're delivering to them with a plate of food, and that you just have to want to work a lot and not shy away from different situations that might arise. And I think you have to have more of like a European kind of, like, you know, you're doing a like you're in a European kitchen and you're starting your career, and they'll send you to different restaurants and different chefs if you do a good job for those chefs. And you just have to want to work. There's lots of
different influences. It's almost like what I say, it's like being in Florence during the Renaissance, and you mm-hmm. had the ability to go into all these different studios of Michelangelo and Titian and all, and
definitely
you've got to have a baseline of skill set to get into a good studio, but then you have to kind of observe from the masters. So how important was your art degree, not just at that stage, but, you know, what you do today? Is it important for a young person to experience a lot of outside life and not cut themselves so, you know?
I think that's a great point. I think the hard part about working your way up through the ranks of a kitchen is you do learn from outside experience and travel and so forth. So I think as a young aspiring cook or chef, that you really want to be able to find a mentor, somebody that's really going to get your career started in the right direction. At the same time, will allow you to, you know, like go abroad or send you to another kitchen, because you've kind of, you just need to have a lot of different experiences. And I think whether you're going to Italy or France or Spain, they're all important. And not even just cooking, it's like tasting food, seeing the different cultures, how that kind of rubs off on you is just as important as like the technique that you're going to learn in the different kitchens. And if you don't do that, like, because I know from firsthand experience that sometimes you start a restaurant and you're caught up in running your business, and you may be like 2-3 years before you're able to get out and travel again, and then things happen so quickly in the food world that you know, it's years later and a whole trend has happened, and you haven't missed out on it, but you really haven't been able to say, you know, go to Spain and spend 3 months in a Spanish kitchen or just eat around, or it's tough because
When you went to cooking school, right after cooking school, did you go to Europe?
No, I went directly to San Francisco and then started working in San Francisco. And then I was in San Francisco and basically was working in a kitchen, and I had a kind of a freak injury where I ripped up my knee in a kitchen, and I had to do like physical therapy and was out of work for maybe 4 months. And then I was able to then go across the bay since I was working in San Francisco, and I went to Chez Panisse, and then I worked there. And then after I left Chez Panisse, I was more, that was more French Provençal oriented. So I wanted to go to Provence and work, and then, which I did.
Where did you work in Provence?
There was a small kind of relais chateau property outside of Avignon in Crillon-le-Brave. So it's a small property owned by two Canadian gentlemen.
So you're an American, you go into a French kitchen, you've been working in American kitchens, you've gone to culinary school. What was it like going into a French kitchen in Europe?
It was, I wish my language skills would have been better, you know, even with all the studying of French. I felt like, you know, started at an early age, and I feel like it's great that, you know, when there's a language program at at culinary institutes, that it's so important to be able to even just have like general terminology, food terminology, and be able to talk about say French cuisine, but to really be able to explore like Italian cuisine was important. So for me, once the language skills improved, I enjoyed myself more, but I have to be honest, it was, you know, it's hard. It's everything happens so quickly in a kitchen, and if you can't understand your commands that you're being given, then you know, you...
How long a day was it when you were in that kitchen?
Oh, probably like, you know, 14, 16 hours, something like that.
And were you working in America that length of day?
Well, when I opened up, Quince at the old location, yeah, that was like, you know, 18 hours or for, you know, probably 4 or 5, close to 6 years before we moved over here. So it's definitely a survival of the fittest mentality that you have to have if you want to own your own restaurant, and especially in a city like San Francisco. So yeah, I never shied away from doing anything extra to help out in any kitchen that I worked at, whether it was, you know, if I worked at Chez Panisse during the day in the cafe, and I'd volunteer to work in the downstairs at nighttime. So I feel like when you're that age, you should, you know, every day you should get as much like a quality day in a kitchen and learn as much as possible. And
so who in that first, let's say, third of your professional life, who were your major mentors? Or what was the major influence to shape you?
Well, it was definitely about, it started off as like, say, working at Chez Panisse for Alice, and like just the aesthetic of, you know, what that restaurant was about in terms of how they procure products and the way they treat products, and the connection from having their farm, which you would basically see somebody pull up with a truck every day coming from the farm, and that it was definitely more about the, in a more Italian verbiage, the materia prima of what they were, just the raw products they were bringing in every day, and the connections to the farmers and how they worked with the farmers. And that was the greatest influence that they had on me. And then from a technique standpoint, you know, and it was also the relationships that you had at that time period, whether it was, you know, like Peggy Smith from the Cowgirl Creamery now, you know, who's a great artisan cheesemaker and just a great person to work with her, Catherine Brandel, who was there with her, who unfortunately, you know, passed away at an age that was way too young. You know, it was like they were the chefs, but then I got to work with, you know, a lot of people that were behind the scenes there that either decided to stay there for a long period of time or went into other businesses, like a Michael Sullivan from Bone Imports, whose brother is Steve Sullivan from Acme Bread. So there's all these different like connections that you have there. Jean-Pierre, there was just a diversity of like these different folks. And then you throw in like working with Paul Bertoli, and that was towards the end of my time there. But he was probably the greatest influence in terms of the way I kind of cook today, combined with like everything else that I learned. He was more technique and a sensibility and an Italian awareness that I don't think I had, nor do I think that restaurant had at that time period, where I think he definitely laid the groundwork for what I was going to do in the future. And then I ended up working for him for a number of years, and he was the person who started taking me to Italy, and you know, like we stayed at with a family in Modena at a Cooper's house, and we would just go on day trips to, you know, to visit somebody making culatello, like Massimo Spigaroli that we were talking about earlier, to a gentleman making Parmigiano Reggiano, and then the folks that we were staying at were he was a Cooper, but you know, the whole family, you know, had generations of making aceto balsamico, not only the barrels but the vinegar production. And then so I was able to meet that family, and then we would go on day trips just to visit all these artisan, you know, food producers. And that was definitely probably the, you know, to get away from California and to go to Emilia Romagna, that definitely changed everything, because I was always interested in French food, and still am, but I was able to see elements of, you know, like in an interaction between Italy and France, and that I still kind of carry with me today. I can remember things that I ate at that time period and where I ate them at, and I always was very fond of, you know, I think as a chef you have to be open to all sorts of dining experiences and the way you kind of cook, and to be able to see, you know, elegant Italian food, and then see the same thing in, you know, in whether it's in a different region, and it could be Emilia Romagna, it could be Alto Adige, it could be Piemonte, to see that. So I think most Americans have a, you know, they always think of Italian food as like, in a not as an elegant as it is sometimes if you're. And like the chefs that are out today, because I think they were constrained for a number of years of always just cooking the food from the region that they're in, and there was like these shackles on them that through all the changes in the last number of years that you know, you see this interaction between, you know, chefs that have spent time in Spain and France and Italy, and the Spanish chefs and the French chefs spend time in Italy, and they see the greatness of Italy and Italian cuisine, and the Italians are spending time in France and in Spain, and the techniques are move around at such a fast rate these days that allowed me to, once I saw all that, you know, I could come back and say, you know, like I can cook in a way that it still respects, you know, French food and the elegance of it and the service and the dining experience, but with Italian flavor profiles.
My gosh, you just described Quince. So wait, we're going to take a little break here. We're going to come back and we're going to get into the Quince story of how all those Michelin stars we won. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Michael Tusk of Quince Restaurant. We're sitting here in San Francisco in his incredibly elegant, beautiful restaurant. So Michael, How did this all come about? I mean, it's extraordinary between Quince, and then you sort of have the kitchens in the middle, and you have Cortona, which is more a brasserie or, you know, or a trattoria.
Exactly.
Yeah, next door, if we're using different influences. So how does this happen to somebody easily?
Well, since we're open 10 years now, we just had our 10-year anniversary, and I had a 10 nights of guest chefs coming from around the country, from New York and Los Angeles and Charleston and Alabama and so forth. Just came from a lot of work. And I think the biggest lesson I could teach anybody that's going to into this profession is you have to take a risk, and you got to roll the dice, and kind of, if you have that passion for wanting to run your own restaurant, and then you just have to kind of go for it. And I was supposed to run kind of like a luxury inn on the Sonoma coast, and that was going to get built. And so I left a job, and then that didn't really come to fruition. And I just decided to start looking for a restaurant around the. There was always this kind of growing up in the East Coast, there was always kind of a pull to maybe, you know, go back and do something in the East. And then I just kind of felt that this was my home. I was going to stay here, and just started looking for a restaurant, and finally found after I think it was almost a 1.5-2 year search the old spot on Bush and Octavia, and you know, just wanted to, you know, was there
a thing inside of you saying, okay, I've just experienced all of this working with various people who are inspiring, I've eaten all of these foods, you've come back to San Francisco, and you could have gone to New Orleans or in New Jersey, Northeast, New York, but you came back to San Francisco. What is it inside you? Is it like the artist of saying, now it's time for me to do my own painting? Is it your point of view of food that you wanted to get through? What is that thing inside you that needed to come out and take the risk, as you said, and the 18 hours a day? How do you describe that?
I think it's just a cumulative effect of what you've learned from different people, and then you're in a very straightforward fashion. You just want to be able to cook your own kind of food, and I think the friends that have either, you know, worked for me or running restaurants, they've had that same feeling, like you don't want to be told, you know, what to do by anybody, you know, whether it's it's just your time to, it's your food, it's what you're going to do and your expression, and you just
You have one dish burning inside you that you said, when I finally get my restaurant, this dish is on it?
Well, yeah, kind of. At that point, the biggest inspiration I would have to say would be a meal that I had in Piemonte, and I was with two Italian winemakers, and I left the Bay Area to go on a trip by myself, and I ended up in Barbaresco, and I was in Barbaresco, and I was taken out by Aldo Vaca, who is from the Predatory de Barbaresco, and he took me out with Paolo Sirocco, who's a Moscato producer, and we went to Da Guido in Costaiole, and that was definitely the restaurant that I saw this kind of combination of everything that I loved about French cuisine, and the service and the elegance of it, and I had been eating at restaurants throughout Piemonte that were a little bit more of like osterias and so forth, and just didn't have the money to go to a different experience. And they took me there, and everything that I had up to that point, whether it was carne cruda or tagliarin or panna cotta or any of the dishes that I was eating on a daily basis, I had there, and they were just much more refined and elegant and lighter, and just had this kind of blissful quality to everything that I ate. It was just I can tell you the entire meal from start to finish of what we had and what we drank, and that kind of changed everything, because I saw Italian flavor profiles in the dishes, but you know, it was just served in a different, in a totally different, like, kind of arena of dining that I'd ever been to before. And when I returned to the Bay Area, you know, I was definitely influenced by Piemontese cuisine, and that was, but definitely I wanted to open up a restaurant.
So you had a dream. How do you get the money? To be blunt.
that you have to scratch and kind of claw, and
then that takes a different skill set. So did you know how to do that?
I just kind of lucked out, and in between coming back from some of these trips and the inn that I was supposed to open up not taking place, I was able to kind of stay busy doing some like catering in San Francisco and the Bay Area, and I was just able to meet a lot of through one family in particular. They just introduced me to a lot of people in the art world, which is great since I was already interested in art, and I was able to cook for them and meet a lot of different influential people that, you know, just saw me cook for them for this kind of interim period where you know, it was just a...
So they became your backers.
They did, and then, you know, family, definitely my my wife Lindsay's family and my family.
Who's your partner in the restaurant?
Exactly, and she's I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her, and you know, she was definitely the design and the business and the somebody that was much more elegant talking to these individuals, and where I was in the kitchen, but it wasn't done in a way that I said I have to meet these people to. It just came about in a natural kind of fashion. And
so,
then,
what was the first year like having your own restaurant? What was the biggest surprise for you? And what was the biggest, you know, great moment?
I'd say the first year was hard, like. Just certain people that you've put trust in kind of like may not kind of work out, like, you know, some folks crack under the pressure of, like, I mean, you start a restaurant, you're going to be there every day for, you know, I think I was there for like a couple hundred days in a row, like, you know, 7 days a week. It wasn't anything, but, you know, you kind of have to thrive on that, and you have to, like, you've got these reserves because this is what you've been set out to, that's your mission in life, to get this restaurant open you know, make a first and foremost for people to taste your food and want to, you know, to see somebody smiling in your own, you know, it's like you're having a dinner party and you're taking a dish out to your friends. That's that same feeling of them really enjoying relaxing and not thinking about their outside life for a 2.5 hour span and really eating and drinking and being comfortable is what I think I really wanted to do with that kind of location. So it just kind of worked out in a way, but it wasn't easy by any means. It got very busy very quickly. At that point, I just wanted it to be more of like a neighborhood kind of restaurant. It was definitely influenced, if you looked at the first kind of menus, by certain regions in Italy. You know, it was very, you know, it was Piemontese, but I think when you're an American who's not Italian, then I've always just wanted to pay homage to these different regions. And then as time kind of progressed, now I want to, you know, put little nuances of myself into the food. But it was like, you know, you look back, I don't care if it's, you know, 1, 3, 5 years and the way you cooked at a certain time period, the whole world has changed the way people think about, you know, and back in that time period of 2003 or 4, you know, you'd get a review and it would be, there was an actual magazine that you'd be waiting to come out. Now, before you're under construction, there's people photographing, you know, the construction site, everything is magnified. So I feel for the younger generation that, you know, everything's so immediate now that you just have to deliver from the moment you open up or things aren't going to work out the way you want to. So
10 years ago, you opened your restaurant, you're working like a dog, or donkey, as Alan Siak would say, and you're doing the comfort food. But now, look at look at Quince. It's one of the most sophisticated rooms I've ever been in anywhere in the world, and beautiful. And you're still doing a comfort food in an elegant way. Where was that evolution? How did you get from there to here? How did that happen?
Well, I always liked whether I was in, you know, a restaurant in Paris or a restaurant in Italy that did have kind of more progressive food. And I think I was always open to, I think you have to be open to change as a chef and especially in a fine dining arena. You know, you learn from people that work for you also. And you know, if somebody in my kitchen spent time in Japan, then I'd like to, you know, have them teach me something. And it's just an interaction with your own staff and your immediate inner crew of chefs that you, you know, if I sit down to write a menu for the spring, you know, I basically just write a list down of everything that first and foremost I like, whose product I want to use, because it's like a great example would be right now. I've been waiting for a couple weeks, and my favorite winter citrus is the Kishu Mandarin from Jim Churchill Farm, and like I can eat those Kishus by the whole basket. I can eat them, and he's a great farmer, and I think his product is so amazing that I just want to feature it. And I try to do that with whether it's Puntarelle or Salsify or anything. I just try to hone in on, like, you know, who has something that is what I consider to be better than anybody else's, and then I have those relationships built, and then I try to pass that on to the people that work for me, and then they may pass on, like, just a more modern technique on how to prepare something, and then you have that under your belt. And you know, it's just it's always about nonstop kind of learning, and you have to be open to evolving and changing, and that's what makes it exciting to be in a professional kitchen in a restaurant on a daily basis. If you didn't have that element of change and desire to learn, you know, I've got a new pastry team, husband and wife, Alan Ramos and Carolyn Nugent, and you know, like, I can learn from him every day. I've never seen, you know, they're constantly, like, you know, you want people that want to push on a daily basis, and you learn from them, and you know.
So what are you learning from them?
God, like, you know, just the other day for New Year's Eve, I had this kind of a blown sugar. It looked like almost like a Christmas ornament at L'Ambroisie when I was in Paris last year. I hadn't been to Paris in like 17 years, and I had this dessert that it was the blown sugar, and inside of it was this pistachio ice cream and amarena cherry. And you know, I just spoke to them. I showed them the picture on my phone, and I said, I think this would be really pretty great to do on New Year's, but with blood orange instead of the version that I had. And you know, the next day, their sous chef, Mindy Bieber, was just in the kitchen, and I looked through the window, and there was this beautiful orange toned ball. And I mean, they had to make 120 of them, and they're very labor intensive, it's like no questions asked, just like, you know, done. We need this to do it. And those are the kind of, you know,
they had the techniques.
Yeah, no, they
and so they could do it, and also add the artistry.
Very much so. Like, the technique was key. Learning how to do that. You know, I definitely go more in a savory, you know, style of cooking. But so they've lent an entirely new dimension to, I think, Quince, and likewise with some of the younger chefs that are running the kitchen, and where they've worked and what they bring to the table. And then it's my job to kind of stir everything up and decide, like, what is going to work in this, like, new evolution of the restaurant, while at the same time being honest about the way I kind of cook. And I always do that with the choice of the products. So if I could teach them about, you know, something that's going on in Modena and that style of food, and we could, you know, pay tribute to it in a dish, but you know, that's what I try to do with them. And then they teach me in return. And then, and that all, that interaction, you know, kind of just goes throughout the kitchen.
Yeah, and that's the evolution. So we're going to take a little break here, and we'll be back. And I want to talk to you about what, where you see the future of your cuisine and what's happening in America today and what's important to you. So we'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today's guest is Michael Tusk of Quince Restaurant, and we're sitting in the private room of his elegant and beautiful Quince Restaurant. So, Michael, what scares you most about the evolution of food right now, and where do you think it's going? What's going to happen in San Francisco in the next 5 years? What are the signs? What are you interested in? Got a whole, I threw it all at you. It's spaghetti on the wall. Take it from wherever you want to take it.
I don't think anything really, really scares me. I think you have to be, like we were talking about earlier, being open to change. And I think the Bay Area in particular is open to, you know, as long as you're honest about what you're doing and not trying to fool anybody. And I think the food in the Bay Area in particular is very, not only progressive, but is very product driven. And I think that really, you know, is something you see, not even in the Bay Area, but when I get to travel, I'm always trying to go to new markets and meeting new chefs from, you know, whether I'm in Charleston or if I'm in Boston or doing different events, I'm always like out and about and wanting. There's been so much change, you know, everywhere in the United States. It's so different than it was. If you went to the Ferry Plaza Farmers Market the first year that it opened up, you'd see maybe a handful of chefs that would be at the market. Now it's just like, you know, like you see every chef in the Bay Area there, and they're all interacting and supporting the local farmers. I think the food has just become much more kind of, you know, natural, but with an underlying, you know, emphasis on technique you know, places like, you know, like a restaurant like Mondresa that has like a farm that they're working with a lot of people.
Apple, yeah.
Yeah. That's a great example of like, you know, great, product, how it's being used and his style of food. I have a lot of respect for those type of restaurants, and there's a lot of, you know, there's just so many great additions to the Bay Area that, and they all cook in a slightly different fashion, but I think a lot of them, you know, are you know, whether they're foraging or buying directly from farmers, or the technique is definitely has just through, you know, technology, like it gets transferred so much faster these days, where, you know, 10 years ago you might have to go to, you know, to France or Spain to go work someplace. Now, you know, there's so many different great, whether it's blogs or you know, you could learn a great deal as like a student just by going on to like YouTube and watching videos of you know, chefs in general. It's just an amazing, you know, and the fact that these culinary institutes can then incorporate a lot of this and then get the information out faster is amazing. Like if I'm trying to make a pasta that I haven't made before, I'll just go watch some videos and try to figure out the technique, and you have to have that desire to want to do that. And I think, but in general, I don't think anything really kind of scares me. I think as long as you're honest about what you're doing and that is transmitted to your guest, then you have, and you want to cook that way. You don't try to be anything that you're not. Then, and I like, you know, giving credit to people in my kitchen when they're at the forefront of what we're doing, because you know, it's my job to orchestrate everything. And if they think the same way that I do about, you know, the raw products that we're acquiring and how we want to present things, then you know, you can always kind of keep track of the trends that are kind of going on. But I think that, you know, like anything, there'll be a resurgence of something that we might have had in the past, and then, you know, things are very cyclical where, you know, I think things have changed, though, for the better. I think the food's much more healthier in the Bay Area. Healthier. There's so many different artisan.
You lead the way in California. I mean, the trends start here. So we're going to have to, unfortunately, this just whizzed by, this whole interview. Can you make a prediction of something in the next 5 years that's going to be important or evolutionary?
That is a tough one. I couldn't say anything like...
Is there a cuisine that you're curious about that if, you know, you could take a month off, you would go live in this country?
I definitely would like to spend time in Japan. Mm. And that's something that I really haven't had the chance to do. Mm-hmm. Definitely something really that's on the top of my list. If I had to say anywhere that I'd like to spend time, it would definitely be going to Japan. I'm not great with predictions. I feel like I spoke about earlier, things always kind of come full circle, and something that we might have overlooked. That's a great thing about some of the restaurants that I have been lucky enough to work at. And, if you look at, say, the way people are just the whole, whether you're in Brooklyn or San Francisco or anywhere around the country, that there is always an emphasis on these where things are from, how they're prepared, who's making them. That wasn't really, and especially where things are from. And then being able to work at a place like, starting off in Berkeley, at a place like Chez Panisse, that definitely educated me on that. And then I saw an artisan, somebody like Paul, who was you see, like, how many more salumi companies do you see in the country right now? And I feel like those were things that I definitely saw 10 or 15 years ago that were definitely going to be important. Now it's kind of commonplace, and to see that at the beginning was great. So I'm sure though I'm missing something, but for the most part.
It's been a wonderful interview, and it's been full of wisdom.
Thanks.
And I want to thank you.
I had one other thing.
The
one thing I'd say that, I think that there's, for the future, I think that chefs in particular can definitely pave the way for change just outside of their kitchens. And then you see so many chefs, for the last 3 years, I've been the chef chair for Share of Strength and Taste of the Nation. Those are the kind of things that I think are overlooked, that there are so many chefs, whether it's Mark Vetri and Suzanne Goen, like what they're doing with Alex's Lemonade, and there's, when we can get outside of our own kitchens and work to really support these causes, that's something that I think that is overlooked sometimes by the general public, that the chefs are getting out of their kitchens and they are supporting great causes that are a lot more important than just serving our guests. That if we could, fight children's cancer and homelessness and people that don't have enough food right now, that's probably, if we can do anything besides what we're doing in our own kitchens, it's definitely getting out there and putting ourselves and what we're cooking a backseat to what we can do for future generations.
I think chefs are among the most generous people in the world, and that's a wonderful way to end this interview.
I appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Michael.
It was great talking to you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time. A shout-out to my producers, Jack Inslee and Robin Cohen. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.